If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I like to buy problems that people go, uh-oh, this isn't going to work, because I know I can bring value to that situation. So when this deal presented itself, the story was phenomenal. And today, we look for that story on every deal we buy.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
John Cohen co-founded Toro Real Estate Partners in 2015. He has been investing in real estate since 2010 and focusing on deals where tremendous value can be added. Since starting in real estate, he has been involved in over $500 million in various real estate transactions. John started their podcast, The Real Estate Investing Experience, to give back to the real estate community. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. Hopefully I can help some listeners out.
Absolutely. The same questions ask everybody who comes on. Where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
I started in finance. But prior to that, I am not, I say finance, it sounds sexy, right? People think it's a good box checker. I'm roll up my sleeves, bull in a china shop, bang my head against the wall a couple times to figure it out. I played baseball in college. So I was just a workhorse, right? You just worked really hard to do what you had to do. Finance was an easy route for me because, I was able to pick up the phone, make a lot of calls. I was a stockbroker, financial advisor, but it was an easy path because, the skill set was, if you could work hard, you were able to do it. And I think that skill set is sort of what, put me in the position where I am today. So, started playing baseball in college. I never, ever had a salary paying job. So from, the earliest recollection of work was raking leaves. My parents paid me $10 an hour to pay off a pair of Jordans that I bought. So, $10 an hour, I guess that's, a salary. But it was always, work, earn something to get something. Then it was all commission-based for, the entire time. So, that was my background, right? I didn't come from I got everything I wanted as a kid. So I don't want to say that I didn't get anything. I wasn't given anything. I was dirt poor. No, that's not the case. My parents gave me every single thing I possibly wanted. Came from a great family, mother and dad. Mother and father did anything for me. Dad coached our little league, coached our basketball team, never missed a game. My mom did everything. My mom's a saleswoman and my dad is an attorney and a CPA. So they brought us up. They taught us the ropes. And that sort of framed, where I was. The next part of that is, the intern was, financial advisor to real estate agent with a short period of time where I thought I was an investor. So it was finance into real estate, whether it was, I bought some properties for myself. I became an agent. I started doing rentals and sales, got into the commercial real estate world as an investment sales broker, and then quickly realized that the investment world was where I wanted to be. So I bridged together real estate, finance. That's what got me into where I am now, which is multifamily, mobile home park, and land investing. Those are our three, pillars. I would say 95% multifamily, 5% mobile home parks, although that seems to be switching a little bit. And then, the land stuff's sort of been a passion or a hobby in the real estate space. And where I want to go, my vision for real estate was more or less like a country club type environment, not like a pay to play, but more creating a network and a group where people could come do deals together, hang out, talk real estate, hold each other accountable, and put that together. That's my big vision for, what we're doing. I don't think what we do is, I don't have the cure for cancer that I'm not telling anybody about, and I'm going to make millions on it, right? What we do, a lot of other people do. Some people do it a little bit different. Some people are a little bit more unique about it. I think it's a collaboration sport. I think that, we could all learn from each other and help each other. And, that's my big vision. It's not anything other than helping listeners, helping people get involved, because at the end of the day, you need to take action, and taking action is going to, correlate to success. So if I could be the platform for that, that would be the best thing in the world.
Right, right. No, I love that. All that's great. I'm curious. So what was your first multifamily deal?
So my first multifamily deal was a 48 unit in Columbus, Ohio, third-party management, direct mailer, but it was a value-add, super heavy lifting deal, really poor out-of-state ownership.
and a lot of problems from, you know, 70% occupied, 50% collected, you know, nobody was paying rent. There was a lady running a Walmart out of three units. You know, you walked in, she had shoes and clothes and toys. And there was one other lady that had four washer and dryers in her kitchen. She was doing wash for the entire complex, plumbing problems. I mean, you name it, what could go wrong was wrong and bad. At the end of the day, it was a super heavy lift, but it was an awesome learning experience and a super successful deal.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, my question is, what are some of the things you learned from that? But I mean, it sounds like you figured out a way to really make that deal work.
Yeah, so that was my first multifamily deal. And I never wanted to buy the deal that was down the fairway, right? Plug and play. That's not my mentality. There's no fun in that, right? Nothing can go wrong. Things can go wrong with plug and play. But more often than not, you know, I wanted to get my hands dirty. You know, I wanted to get punched in the face to find out what I really knew and what I didn't know. Sure. So what I didn't know, you know, I was a direct mailer. Long story short, the owner called me and said, I'm listing this property on Monday. If you're interested, you know, you got to figure it out and send me a contract. So I jumped in a car Saturday morning or Sunday morning with two friends, drove all the way to Columbus, Ohio, saw the property, got in the car, drove all the way home. 20 hours of driving, drove out there. I fell in love with it. I said, it's exactly what I'm looking for. It appeared to be in much nicer condition than it was, but we put it into contract, which gave us the ability to do due diligence. And even through due diligence, you know, we just realized like, this guy's really mangled this thing. So we learned a lot like on the job training, but we got a great purchase price. You know, he bought the property for $1.6 million. He sold us the building for, you know, I think it was about $890 to $1 million, you know, in that range, give or take. And we put in an additional $400,000 in capital. So we were all in for about $1.4 million, $1.5 million. We sold it for just under $2 million. 18 months later. So it was a heavy lift, but I was super excited I did it because it basically showed that, you know, this business is possible, it's doable. And we learned how to fire a manager, the managers that we should fire, the managers that we should hire. We learned how, you know, screening tenants, you know, plumbing problems, how to, you know, submeter apartments, renovations, what type of renovations, materials. So we got the full hands-on training, drinking from a fire hose, for, you know, lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah. Was there ever any point in that deal in which you were like, what have I gotten myself into?
So I say no, because one, a buddy of mine who did the deal with me, you know, it was a recourse loan that my dad co-signed the loan, and a friend of mine who still invests and partners on deals with us. So this is in 2014. So recourse debt, it was not, you know, that was the option back then. The world was just starting to get its foot underneath it from 2009, 2010.
Sure.
When I say no, you know, I was the one that, you know, in high school took a test, you know, knocked out the test in 15 minutes, handed it in. People are like, well, that was so hard. I'm like, was it? And I got a 35 when I got the grade back. I'm like, I guess that was hard, right? I didn't think it was hard when I was doing it. So when people say, you know, were there ever a time where you said, oh, shit, or uh-oh, I never really have that, right? Because I feel, you know, something people have told me, my dad says it all the time, what's mandatory is easy. You have to get it done. You're either going to get it done or not. So I don't look at that as a stressful or, uh-oh, this isn't going to work situation. I try and go the other way of, okay, how am I going to get this done, as opposed to this isn't going to work? So I say no, but, you know, hindsight's 20/20. You look backwards, you're like, oh, wow, look what we did. If we had this problem today, we wouldn't have done it that way. And if that problem came up today, I would know how to fix it. So there was periods of time where things happened that we rolled with the punches because we didn't know any better. So you're naive, right? You don't know what you don't know. You just learn how to fix it. So looking back, if we would have done that property today, we probably would have sold it for $2.5 million, because we would have done it better and probably executed a lot cleaner, as opposed to just, you know, pulling a china closet. So at the end of the day, I never was nervous about the deal. You know, I knew that it sold for $1.6 million. We bought it well below the market value. I knew there was upside. I knew we could push rents. I knew we could lease it up because the market was really strong. So with that principle behind the deal, I didn't worry. I said, okay, worst case scenario, we're going to get our money back on this. That's sort of how I look at things, to say, okay, worst case scenario, what's going to happen? We're not going to lose. You know, I'll take that gamble.
Right. Hey, so let me ask you this. Would you do that deal today?
All day. So it's on the smaller side, right? I actually just got an email right before this, right before we started recording, because he sent us a deal and it was on the smaller side. It was like 96 units. I said, you know, I'm going to pass. It's a little small. And he wrote, well, what's too small? And I said, it's not about too small. You know, too small, if there's not value, I can't really do that. Would I do that deal again all day long? Because, you know, the things that we believe in are great purchase price, great location, great market, right? It had every one of those things, right? I'm not saying anyone doesn't know. Real estate is location, location, location. You make your money when you buy. You know, we've taken those concepts and we've anchored in there and we've hooked our teeth into there and we're not going to bend. So that deal has since sold two times at ridiculous prices. And that isn't why I buy it. I would buy that deal again because everything about that deal was what we look for today. And the most important thing that I think a deal has is a story. And the story on that deal was just, you know, it spit in your face. Like, if you don't buy this, you're losing an opportunity because the story is everything, right? Do I want to buy a deal from someone that bought it 24 months ago, renovated 20 units, and now is selling it at a value add? Well, they probably know something I don't. Why are they trying to get out of it quickly? If there really is a rent premium, why don't they continue it? Blah, blah, blah. I like to buy problems that people go, uh-oh, this isn't going to work because I know I can bring value to that situation. So when this deal presented itself, the story was phenomenal. And today we look for that story on every deal we buy. So if this one came across my desk, one, it's in a market we own 800 units in, so I would easily pick it up. And two, it's a story that I believed in. And a value-add deal to me is something that you see that nobody else does. And then delivering on it is if you're good or bad at your job. So the story is everything. So I would definitely buy that deal today, regardless of size, but I would know how to execute significantly better. So yes, I would buy that deal again.
Right, right. And I think the types of deals that you are comfortable with maybe make a lot of investors leery.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there's a group of us out there for sure that, you know, like playing, you know, we like playing in this space, no doubt. But, you know, this is not, you know, you buy a course and they teach you to find this one, right? You know, we're not buying deals where, oh, look, they're not billing back water. That may be the case, but we look for deals that not only is that the case, but it's dilapidated, it's falling apart. And where people normally get into that, they see the due diligence and they see the financials, they're like, uh-oh, how much is that going to cost? This is going to be a disaster. I'm not going to be able to fix it. We look at that and we thrive because we see, you know, I know I can fix this problem because we've done it before and it's in a market that we're familiar with. And I know that my purchase price saves me. So yes, I think most people don't jive with that idea. You know, I've always been not the herd mentality, right? If people are zigging, I'm zagging. I like to put my neck on the line and I have no problem with, if we make a mistake, I'm the first one to say, yeah, my bad. You know, I messed up, right? I'm not going to make excuses. I messed up, turn the page, let's fix it. As opposed to this whole entire population nowadays, which let's blame someone. It's someone else's fault. I wasn't educated. You know, everyone has a built-in excuse. At the end of the day, it's irrelevant, right? It does not matter. Take the responsibility, own it, accountability, turn the page and fix it. And that's what I like that. I love to be in that situation where I don't want to say a leader is going to, you know, arise, but where if something goes wrong, you know, it's your ass, right? It's just that little motivation that helps me, you know, put myself in situations where my skill set's going to rise.
Right, right. Absolutely. When you rewind the last 6 or 7 years, what are some things that maybe you would do differently than what you've done? You know, if you go back and redo some things, what would they be?
So it's funny. We have a little mastermind group with a bunch of really good guys. And we had this conversation today and we were talking about marketing and raising money and, you know, systems that we all have in place. You get a little complacent sometimes and it goes so against what I believe in and my whole vision. But you get to a point sometimes where you take your foot off the accelerator. And then when you try and put your foot back down, it takes a little while to pick up. So 6 or 7 years, the one thing that I wish I would have done better is, you know, not giving up on, you know, I had a goal. I was meeting 30 new people every month and taking COVID out of it because I stopped doing this way before COVID. But, you know, my goal was 30 new people every month in my CRM or my database or my email and 30 new meetings every month. So, you know, you meet 30 people, that's great. Now interact with 30 people. And then if you do that over the course of the year, 12 months, 30 people a month, you're looking at 360 new contacts over 6 years, 7 years, 5 years. You're talking about 1,500 to 2,000 people to 2,500 people that you didn't know. And it's how you execute on those relationships from month one to month, you know, to year seven. And that right there is success, right? You're gonna be able to find your sphere of influence. You're gonna be able to find, you know, all these books and things they talk about. You're gonna find who you jive with, and you could really build good relationships and really build strong foundation to do super hairy deals, to get in a situation where you might not be able to get yourself out of because you have a really good contact. So that's something I wish I would have never stopped. You know, I do it loosely, but you know, it's not nearly something I should be doing it better and more. And I recommend anybody, if you set that goal, guaranteed success, because you're going to just put yourself in a situation around different people. You never know who you're going to meet.
In today's environment, how do you suggest someone goes about that?
That's an awesome question, because I was doing a podcast the other day and I actually spoke about this, you know, let's call it a year ago, right? More or less, the world came to a, you know, a halt. And then the days of people picking up the phone, going out for coffee, all that good stuff stopped. Now, you know, if we never met before, you sent me an email, hey, can we connect? We jumped on a call. If we were in the same area, we might get food. But now it's like the first introduction that everyone has now is a Zoom link. It's like, wait a second, I don't want to see you yet. So the way that I recommend doing it today is get yourself into some groups, right? Look for some of those online meetups. Those are, I don't want to say they're taking the place, but that's where that first interaction on a Zoom, you know, grab a beer, you know, a virtual beer with people and stuff like that. But like, when I get an email from someone, it's like, oh, hey, I haven't, you know, I saw you in this Facebook group and I want to connect. Here's a Zoom link to my Calendly. I'm like, wait a second, wait, no, let's pretend like there wasn't a pandemic. Pick up the phone. Let's see if we jive at all, right? Shoot me a text, send me an email. So I still think it's important to get out there. Obviously, those events are harder and harder to find. You know, some states are a little bit more lenient. You know, I live in New York, so it's not as lenient, but I still think that environment's good, right? Go into that environment and be an expert, or be, you know, add value to that group, and those meetings will start coming to you. And then you can pick and choose who you want to have a, you know, a video conference with, and then who you want to keep to email, who you want to text. And, but bring something to the group of value or a thought question, you know, do something like that. But that's how I'd recommend it. Just, you know, get yourself into these groups, and, you know, there's no excuse anymore, because you could leave your computer open. You could throw on, you know, throw on some TV or whatever it is. And you can do two things at once. And if you find yourself really intrigued by the group, you know, turn the TV off and get focused. But you have more opportunity now than you ever did, because you don't have to have that in-person interaction. You can sort of tailor who you want that interaction to be with more so than ever because of, you know, technology.
Right, right. Yeah, I think a lot of us have seen that, you know, the gone are the days, maybe not necessarily, but of, you know, going to a RIA or some sort of meetup and then mingling around the room and talking to a half a dozen people and being like, oh, okay, well, that was, you know, interesting. But, you know, I think actually there's a lot more power in your ability to leverage those relationships in its own unique way now, and much more quickly even.
Absolutely.
So that's really cool. Hey, let's jump here into the final four. I've really enjoyed this, and there's so much more here I want to cover. But as always, it's too short of a podcast, man. Here we go. The final four questions are this. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Get involved. Take action. Don't let money, don't let time, don't have an excuse. Get involved. You know, I tell people all the time, a $50,000 investment where you lose every penny is the best decision you can make. Because if you take 3 years to evaluate deals before you invest, that $50,000 loss is going to be your biggest and your most educating experience, because you're going to learn what to do and what not to do. So bottom line, get involved today.
Right, right. Absolutely. What is one way you are staying on top of your game?
I try and read, you know, I had a goal this year to read 52 books. If anyone knows me, I'm not an education person. I had uncles and aunts and people say all the time, like, please don't talk about education around my kids. I want them to go to college. And I'm not, I read my daughter, my 2-year-old daughter books now. And my wife looks at me, she's like, you don't even know how to read a sentence for a 2-year-old, but I listen to audiobooks. And just that next, you know, whether it's a business book, whether it's an autobiography, you know, it's enlightening, right? You could sit down, take an hour a day and just but 30 minutes, 15 minutes, 10 minutes, just get it done and stay on top of that stuff. So to me, it's just me, you know, making sure you get that hour a day, 30 minutes a day of, you know, some type of book. I don't care if it's science fiction or not, just let your mind go and dive into it. So that's what I do.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. Good for you. When it comes to giving back, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
That's a huge thing for me. You know, I think that everybody can give back, you know, whether it's a straight monetary investment or a donation, whether it's giving back education, whether it's helping out somebody. The biggest thing for me is real estate is a team sport. Everyone's had help, right? Don't let anyone fool you. And that help could have been from a bank trusting you, from an investor trusting you. So the one thing that I do to give back, you know, I'm available to anybody, super experienced, billion-dollar investor to someone that just listened to me on one podcast and just happened to like something I say. Reach out to the experts and call. So I'm available for anyone, the most novice investor, super experienced. If you find yourself in a situation, you want another set of eyes to help you out. Doesn't mean I'm right, but I will try and make a connection, because I think that, you know, connecting people with the right people is a way to give back. So whether it's charity, donation, you know, for me, it's making sure that I can leave a lasting, you know, impression on somebody where they can turn with their dream into a reality.
John, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
So the two best ways, my email address is John, J-O-H-N, at Toro, T-O-R-O-R-E-P.com. You shoot me an email, you know, I'll typically get back to someone within 24 and 48 hours. My cell phone number is 516-523-6205. If you call, leave a voicemail. If I don't pick up, or shoot me a text, or you can go to our website. On our website, there's an investor questionnaire form that all funnels to me at the end of the day. If you want to set up a time, you know, there's some questions, but to put in the notes that, you know, either a one-on-one, and you can find me on all social media. I suck at social media, so I would say email and text are the two best ways.
Wonderful. John, thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you. It was awesome being here.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.